Half hour of Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski, and we're here with Stinson Stroop from the Pennsylvania Superintendents Association. And I'd like to just continue a little bit more with, I don't think parents really understand the impact of, and I don't think legislators understand the impact when they pass legislation that is required by law and then don't fund it. And what we were talking about a little bit earlier before the break was the handicap legislation. And I know in this state, we say that we spend $7,000 per child, somewhere roughly around there, whatever it is. And yet, at some point, students who are handicapped, we might pay $100,000 for. And the second part of that question is the impact that litigation has. Oftentimes, a superintendent will opt to not even go through the litigation process, but to give the parent whatever they want in order to save money in the long run from 2 or 3 years. Anyone who's been in court knows that it can go on and on and on and on. So how have these things impacted on the superintendent's position?
Yeah, there are several questions embodied in that. First, in terms of funding, when Pennsylvania began its special education program, and again, we were among the first in the nation to have special education as part of our school programs, it was fully state-funded. That is, the Commonwealth paid the excess costs of providing special education. And the formula was pretty simple, that you'd figure out what it costs to educate a regular youngster in a regular program in the school district, and you'd figure out how much the special education program costs, and the state would pay all of the difference. About 10 years ago, the state moved away from full excess cost funding to a formula funding. The formula was designed to solve several problems at the state level, the most important of which was that the Commonwealth legislature had lost control over that line item of their budget, and that it was a line item of the state budget that was growing rapidly. It was not terribly predictable, in that the Commonwealth often had to fund a deficiency in order to make up the debt it owed to school districts. And there appeared to be no way to put a brake on it, that the legislature was unable to redefine the services so that they would cost less, and they were unwilling or unable to provide the kind of monitoring that they thought would be necessary in order to control costs. And so the result was a formula that says basically this is the amount of state money that's available. We'll give it to the school districts and they'll make up the difference. That difference is now substantial. The Commonwealth, instead of paying all of the excess costs of special education, is probably now paying about 60% of the excess costs of special education. That 40% difference is being made up by local communities, and it has a differential impact on communities. The way the formula works, a district receives a fixed dollar amount times 15% of its enrollment, and another fixed dollar amount times 1% of its enrollment. And the presumption is that the dollar amount that is provided by the Commonwealth is the estimated cost of the program, and that every district has the same percentage of students who fit that cost need. And obviously it's not true, that there are some communities with more than 15% of their students needing special education services. And there are a lot of communities that have to spend much more than the fixed dollar amount that the Commonwealth provides. So that the impact of the change in the state formula 10 years ago has been to place an additional burden on local taxpayers, and they're paying for the special education programs in their property tax, but they don't see it directly because it's embedded in all of the school budget, and it just comes as part of the school tax bill. At the same time that the Commonwealth has been shifting some of the responsibility for funding special education to local districts, they've also been shifting the responsibility to fund the regular education program to local districts. At one time, Pennsylvania funded education on a basically 50-50 basis. that local communities in aggregate were responsible for half the cost and the state was responsible for half the cost. And we're now down to about 38% of state funding, which leaves 72% for local communities, and that again has placed a burden on the local taxpayer, and it shows up in the local property tax. The other question you asked about litigation, it's not only true in special education, but I think probably in every aspect of our life as Americans, that we're much more likely to be sued or to sue than we were 2 decades ago or a decade ago. And litigation is difficult. It's difficult in our personal lives, and it's difficult in our work lives. And particularly, I think, for educators who are not expecting to be sued, are not trained to deal with that kind of legal conflict, it's very difficult. And if a school is trying to be a partner with parents in providing services and instruction for children, and particularly children with disabilities, it's not the way you want to begin the relationship with a lawsuit. And so I think schools do, as you suggest, try to work out the differences with families, and to the extent that they can, they do work out those differences and will bend over backwards to work out those differences. But there are clear cases where there is a strong disagreement between the professionals in the school district and the parents, and they will end up in litigation. And often that's very expensive. But it's not just the money, it's the what it does to the relationships that support that youngster that I think is most important.
I was in one school district about a year ago that had 83 cases. And for that superintendent, I just couldn't even imagine. In any event, actually he had a heart attack afterwards, somewhere in between. We're going to talk a little bit now about the Pennsylvania Superintendents Association. What kinds of support programs do you offer to superintendents, and or can anyone be a part of this? I'm assuming, because it says Superintendents Association, that only superintendents have the opportunity, but is there a way that you probably have? And I'm saying this, I have an ulterior motive. Let me take a few steps back here. It seems that the pyramid structure of top down, bottom up, the information flow doesn't occur the bigger we get. The information from the Department of Education doesn't reach down to students and parents, and the information at the superintendent's level often doesn't get to the teachers and the teachers to the superintendents. So how do you support and assist in this pyramidal structure that's so incredibly complex for the information flow, and what kinds of supporting systems do you give your superintendents?
Again, I think there are several questions embedded in that. First, let me say that increasingly there is not a pyramid of information. That information is readily available to folks who want to find it, and that's particularly true because of the prevalence of websites. And now much of the information that used to not be available to the general public is available to the public through public websites. The Pennsylvania Department of Education has a well-developed website that includes lots of information about school district finances. It includes lots of information about school district student test performance. So that's available to everyone. In the past, it may not have been available to everyone and may have indeed been more pyramidal, in that there were certain folks in the state who knew that and certain folks in the local district who may have had access to that data. In terms of our membership, we are primarily an organization for system heads, but we also have other administrators as members, and we try to provide a wide variety of services to them. Today we had a workshop for folks aspiring to the superintendency. They were primarily superintendents, a few assistants, I'm sorry, they were primarily principals and a few assistant superintendents. And talking with them and having them interact with sitting superintendents about the role and the expectations of the role, trying to address one of the issues we discussed earlier, which is the pool of candidates for the superintendency, trying to make folks appreciate that in spite of the problems, it is a wonderful opportunity for service, and that if they have the calling, it's worth accepting. We also provide support for new superintendents, and we have a three-part academy for new superintendents where we go through some of the role expectations and some of the aspects of the job that they may not have experienced in some of their previous positions. Part of it is just entry, moving into a new community, into a new school system, and being able to read the culture, get a sense of what those local expectations are, getting a sense of what the community wants its schools to be, and the kinds of things that we were talking about earlier in terms of local differences, being able to read those and then being able to take that community from where it is to where it wants to be. We also have a second academy that deals more with the planning aspect of the superintendency, of strategic planning, financial planning, helping the system leader take the system in another direction. And the third part of the new superintendent academy is on evaluation, helping new administrators develop systems for evaluating personnel, for evaluating student performance, and for evaluating themselves and the kind of job that they're doing. In addition to that, we participate with the Pennsylvania School Boards Association in a summer workshop, which also includes business officials and principals. It's probably the only place in the country where there is a unified leadership conference that includes all of the major state leadership organizations. And that takes place in the summer, and this year it will be at Johnstown. And with the School Boards Association, we do a fall convention in which we have the typical major convention speakers and a lot of workshops and a lot of sharing across position lines and an opportunity for school boards and their chief education officers to talk to one another and learn what other folks are doing to solve similar problems in other districts. Continuing with the sort of professional development aspect of what PASA does, we jointly work with the Penn State Study Council, which is part of Penn State University, and Duquesne University in offering the Pennsylvania Leadership Development Center. The center currently operates an assessment program for superintendents and folks aspiring to the superintendency. It's a rigorous 2-day assessment where they work through simulated experiences. It's actually a nonprofit social service organization, but it simulates the kinds of things that a superintendent would face. And while one is going through those activities, one is being watched by six sitting administrators who assess their performance on the various tasks and then provide them with feedback as to their strengths and weaknesses. Folks who have gone through it have found it extremely valuable as a way of learning more about themselves, about their strengths, and how to play to their strengths, and identifying the kinds of things that they need to work on to improve their performance. And growing out of that, we're working with the folks who have participated in the center to identify activities that will be useful for them over the next 3 or 4 years to participate in order to grow, in order to improve. We also have conducted in the past a series of workshops that reach across the state. They're regional workshops on a issue of topical interest. In the past, we have done programs on reading instruction, on whole language. We have done programs on AIDS education when that requirement first came into the Commonwealth. We have done workshops on IDEA and the implementation of the new federal special education law. And we've done workshops on student discipline, sexual harassment, a variety of issues that will affect school administrators and others in school systems, and have often had teachers and other administrators participate in those workshops. Like other organizations, we have a newsletter. You've given your listeners our website, and we try to communicate with folks about issues that are important to education in Pennsylvania. For our members who may be experiencing job difficulty, we provide mentoring, and we'll offer to and do set up mentor relationships between neophyte administrators and more senior administrators. We'll provide assistance on a specific problem if a member is having an issue, and some career counseling, helping folks deal with a non-renewal when the community decides that they don't want them there anymore, and helping folks who are being dismissed midterm, work through the legal aspects of that dismissal, and try to help them when we can land on their feet and move to a community where their skills are needed and appreciated.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here with Stinson Stroop of the Pennsylvania Superintendents Association. The phone number here is 717-540-4448. That's 717-540-4448. Or the website is www.pasa/net.org. That's www.pasa/net.org. Or you can reach us at Children Come First toll free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. You briefly alluded when you first started talking to the information flow, as I said, it was a pyramid structure in the technology and information access today, and the fact that many people have access to the kinds of information that were selective in the past. And I wanted to know if you foresee a change in the structure of education, because with everyone having access and with everyone, there's a definite diversity between a school board and the expertise of a school board and a superintendent and or a principal. And I'm not belittling, but I'm saying because they are elected officials, they don't always have the information. With this type of information flow, does it behoove us to look at a different structure of management in terms of what we have today? Or is there a way that we can collaborate to make a more flatline approach, so to speak, in a managerial style?
I don't know if it behooves us to make a change. I think we have to make changes. And the whole world is changing. It's not just schools. But when everybody has access to information, it is much harder to keep secrets. And decisions have to be much more open. And I think they are more open than maybe they have been in the past. When everybody has access to information, context of that information becomes more and more important. And I think probably the leader's job is less to provide the facts than to provide the context and to help people understand what the data means, and to be prepared to put context around the kinds of individual units of data that people are picking up off the website or off talk radio or whatever source they have for information. But again, it's not just schools. I think we have seen government change dramatically because of the access of information and the prevalence of websites and other internet information. But it's also going to affect the way we instruct youngsters, because youngsters have access to all of this information too. And it, I think, means that the teacher's role is going to be less instructing, less presenting information to young people, and more about helping young people understand that information, knowing how helping them manipulate that information to get the kind of results that they need so that they can put the information into practice. Understanding is going to become critical, and context is going to become critical, and that will become the educator's job.
And filtering, I might add, we have so many factoids. It's very different it's very, very different world for our children who want to watch a baseball game and find out about all kinds of information that really is insignificant, even when you go to the movie theater these days. And part of that transformation has been, I think, one of the major barriers in education has been, and many professions, the medical profession, the law profession, has been rhetoric. The language that we use. I've interviewed legislators and educators alike, and each uses its own rhetoric that most of the population who listens to my radio program don't understand, IEPs and PEPs and PETs, and most people don't understand what educators are talking about and have been threatened in the past. And now with the information age, that barrier is slowly diminishing so that there is much more of a less of a communication gap and more understanding with people knowing the kinds of things that are going on. And in that context, where I'd like to segue into, what does it take to be an educational leader today in the 21st century compared to, now you've been here for years, compared to years ago, what does it take to be a leader? And how is it different than it was, you know, 20 years ago?
It's difficult to answer on short notice. Clearly what it has always taken to be a leader is to have followers. And I don't mean that flippantly, but I think it probably takes different skills to speak to followers now than it may have in the past. That in the past there was a lot of respect for position, and that if one held a position, one automatically had a certain cadre of followers. Less and less that is true. You have to earn your followers, and I think you earn it by doing some of the things we've talked about, by speaking without rhetoric, if possible, by showing understanding of where a community is, where teachers are, where parents are, and showing them a vision of where they can be if they put their mind and soul in it, and then helping folks develop a plan to get from where they understand they are to where they understand they want to be. And that's probably always been a leader's job. It's just more difficult now than it may have been in the past.
What is the general span of time what's the average year for a superintendent with all the stresses that we've talked about and all the pressures? And I don't want to say lifespan because I don't want to get into that part of it, but how long do they normally, what's the average for them to stay in a position in the state of Pennsylvania?
I'm glad you asked that, because there's some mythology, I think, around a superintendent's tenure. In Pennsylvania, it has been a fairly constant average of about 6 years in a position. There is, I think, a belief that it's a much shorter period. And if you look nationally in the urban superintendencies, it is a shorter period. But in Pennsylvania, including our urban districts, we have a fairly stable tenure of around 6 years. Now, obviously, there are communities in which the same person has been superintendent for a decade or more, and other communities that have turned over superintendents more rapidly. But the average is about 6 years.
Gee, and I don't consider that a very long period of time, frankly speaking. But then when we look at the number of jobs a person has in a lifetime in terms of the national average, I guess that's equatable to the national average. Is there a camaraderie of superintendents across the state? I talked earlier about the diversity of the state itself and the rural versus the city. And I also have interviewed many of the superintendents across the state, and they're not only their knowledge base of the world and change and things of that nature, and their own communities are different and vast, but their educational, their personal philosophies, there is a huge diversity of the 500 superintendents themselves. Is there some common thread among them all across the state?
I think there's a great deal of camaraderie. One of the things that I've noticed in this position is the extraordinary extent to which they care for one another, care about one another, respect one another, even when they disagree almost violently on various aspects of the job and how that job is performed. They have a lot of appreciation for the role that their colleague is in, and will provide a lot of support to one another in those roles. There's a great deal of caring across this profession, and it's nice to be a part of it.
Is there is talk of perhaps changing the way we develop teacher training programs to more aptly respond to student needs, with things like the technology changing rapidly, and for the most part, a person in a job is 5 years, their skills are obsolete. How do superintendents keep up with the kinds of the volumes of information that are, I mean, I know myself, I get 100 emails a day. I can't even imagine what it must be like to be a superintendent with the phone calls and the responsibility to the community, to the parents, to students, to teachers. How does one keep up with all of that information, and what kinds of skills does it take to do that?
It takes 28-hour days. Now, it's extraordinary the kind of pressure just on time placed on chief education officers. I think there are a couple of questions in what you ask. One is just the day-to-day survival of communicating with all of the people that want to be communicated with, that have questions, and that want the answer from the superintendent or the system head. And email has certainly complicated that, because many people now have email, and they have the superintendent's email address, and they expect an answer immediately. It used to be that we had a few days to think about and reflect on a question, and now folks want an answer much more quickly than they did in the past. But it also makes it easier to communicate with a lot of people, because one doesn't have to play phone tag for 3 days in order to get back to somebody. So there are pluses and minuses with that technology. Just in terms of keeping current, some of the things that I described as services of our organization are designed to help administrators stay current. We have an education congress every spring in which we invite a prominent author to talk about a recent work. And we make the book available to everybody before the session, and they come and they talk with, this spring it was Howard Gardner, talked with Dr. Gardner about his work on the disciplined mind. And so that's one of the ways that folks stay involved. Many of them read professional journals on a regular basis. And many of them are involved in professional book clubs and discuss current literature. And certainly they're well aware of new legal requirements because of things that we put out, things that the School Boards Association publishes, and things that the State Department of Education publishes. So there are a lot of sources for current information. The state has also adopted new certification requirements that apply to all certificate holders, and that would include teachers as well as administrators and superintendents, in that they must complete 180 hours of professional development every 5 years. So that will address some of the needs of the profession from top to bottom in order for them to stay current with what you identify as an extraordinarily fast-paced world. And many learn from one another. They learn from not only colleagues but subordinates, and they learn from students. Students have taught educators a great deal about technology as well as about other things.
Well, I was in an office the other day, a superintendent's office, and they just made a regulation where you could no longer carry a backpack in school, and there were 100 phone calls at least while I was sitting in his office. The poor secretary was totally frustrated, but in any event, talking about the inundation of information, is there anything you'd like to say to summarize in our last few seconds here? Is there anything you'd like to say in summation?
No, except that I think our members are certainly an important part of public education, and they believe passionately every day that public education is an important part of the life of the communities they serve, and they want to continue to do that.
You have been listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We are here with Stinson Stroop from the Pennsylvania Superintendents Association. You may call him at 717-540-4448. That's 717-540-4448. Or you can call us at Children Come First toll-free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PRO-KIDS. Thank you for joining us, and join us again next week. Have a good week.